Okay. I want to begin by thanking all of you for coming. It's great to see everybody here, and one of the highlights of my summer always is just hearing the sound of the Torah being learned seriously in a baby Joshua Martin.
It's a serious Jewish study
in which people take as importance as one of the joys of my life. I want to thank GAN Academy for agreeing to co-sponsor this event and for generously giving us the facility for tonight. An expression of the shared commitment with GAN and the Center for Torah Leadership to a Torah that has alive messages for the society we live in. I want to thank especially Debbie Golden, Director of Development at GAN, who basically did all the logistical work to publicize this event and to make it happen, and is responsible largely for all of you coming here. Special thanks to my colleague Dr. John Golden
for coming.
The specific origin of this event is in my own commitment, number one, from childhood, of a deep appreciation of the Jewish speech ethic, which is usually assumed under the Hebrew title Lashon Hara,
roughly translatable evil speech.
A really deep appreciation of the significance and importance of that value, conjoined with an equally deep commitment born of later experience to the necessity of investigative journalism for a moral society. And recognizing that those two values are often, at least as generally presented, in deep tension with each other. We had yesterday Gary Rosenblatt, editor of the New York Jewish Week, speaking to our program, and he told the story of early in his career where he invited a rabbi to speak to the staff of the newspaper that edited, and the rabbi's guest lecture essentially consisted of reading those sections of the classic Jewish work on speech ethics, the Chafetz Chaim, which bans saying anything negative about anybody and ending the conversation. And that seemed to make the point implicitly that there didn't seem to be much room both for a biblical Jewish speech ethics and to the value of investigative journalism. And I'm committed that there has to be a way for both. So in expression of that commitment, I started this year at GAN teaching a senior class, which my seniors were generous enough to be willing to sign on for, which was, I think, uniquely in GAN experience, a class that was explicitly aimed at ethical self-improvement, in which the students as a group agreed from the outset that our goal in the class was not so much to gain academic knowledge, but to figure out if we could create an environment and a personal habit which enabled us to live more fully in accordance with the Jewish speech ethic. That was one aspect, is just trying to see how Lashon Hara, Jewish speech ethics, can translate into the lives of people who are not living in a community that necessarily wholly endorses Jewish law as a whole, but just taking that aspect of it. Secondly, I organized this year's Summer Bit Midrash, about which there are brochures there, and you have the center's brochures as well, and Ann Sender, who is also very much responsible as program director for this event, has sign-up sheets, and I hope that all of you both signed up by the end of the evening. I organized this summer's Summer Bit Midrash, which is an intensive seminar designed to give students the experience of making Jewish law around the question of journalistic ethics. So we've been spending now, we're in our second week of intense study of the halacha, of Jewish law as it relates to speech ethics, and Mark Jerkowitz will be speaking to us momentarily. Just spent several hours with us today presenting on the ethics of journalism from the perspective of the journalist. What I thought would be an interesting parallel tonight would be to reverse the lens and instead of talking about the issues from the perspective of the producer of news, to talk about the responsibilities that we have as consumers for creating an information environment that reflects our values, and to what extent we find traditional Jewish values to be significant in the way we construct our vision of an ideal information environment. What the sources that you've all done together now, I think, suggest, and I hope that after Mark's speech that you'll all be, or during, you'll all be asking questions based on it to see how compatible they are, where they compare and contrast, and what you see as strengths and weaknesses. But I would set out one facet, that there are some elements of the ethic which relate to our responsibility for ourselves. Given that we exist in a particular environment, how are we supposed to react to that environment? Are there things that we have to close our eyes to, and other things that we have the responsibility to find out? And then a sort of peculiar intermediate stage, that there are things that we have to believe, and yet be certain that we only believe to a certain degree. To maintain a very complicated, nuanced, critical attitude toward the information we provide. And secondly, it's responsibility for society, which is not just given the environment, what is our responsibility towards it, but what is our responsibility for the environment both that we find ourselves in and the environment that we create for others around us. After that introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Turkis in this presentation. And format is Mark's going to present. There's lots of time to ask questions about that. Following that, I'm going to sort of give a rabbinic response to that whole conversation, and then we'll open the floor. You can ask whatever you want, whatever you want. And I'll do. Mark Turkis is the associate director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism and the former ombudsman of the Boston Globe and writer of the Don't Quote Me columns for the Boston Phoenix. When I designed this program, he was the first name that we thought of as someone to bring in, and I'm very glad that he agreed to come.
Thank you. I worked for a couple of organizations where involved with a couple of phrases anyway that made it sound like oxymoron. The Project for Excellence in Journalism. We can debate that for a while. That's why we're still in business. It's going to be a long time before we have it. And also, I taught a course at both Northeastern and Tufts for a number of years called Media Ethics. And the first words out of my mouth, day one of the course was, no, that's not an oxymoron. The task that the rabbi and students are going to undertake, I wish them the best of luck. It's one that's bedeviled journalism and journalism organizations, coming up with codes of ethics that basically withstand the pressures of deadlines, competition, changing technology, and now obviously the changing economic environment in the newspaper industry. I will just preface my remarks with this. When I taught the course at Northeastern and Tufts, I decided that, I mean, every news organization, every responsible news organization has, and they're on file, and you could find them, and people would email them to you, a code of ethics. And it's quite specific, and it's quite responsible, and it's often quite detailed. The problem is that much of those guidelines to behavior can evaporate in the heat of battle. And evaporate for the most mundane reasons. And I can say this because I was the Boston Globe's ombudsman. Now, for those of you who know what an ombudsman is, I'd like to say there are about 1,400 daily newspapers in the country. There are about 30 ombudsmen. And it's no mystery why there are only about 30 ombudsmen. One of the ombudsman's main jobs is to be the complaint department for his or her newspaper, which means listening to dozens, or scores, or hundreds of emails and angry phone calls every day. Human nature being what it is, 99% of them were negative. You would get the occasional nice story, but not often. I always thought there was actually a physiological component to that. I mean, you think about it, you read something in a newspaper that outrages you. It's unfair, it's wrong, whatever it might be. Think about all the things that happen to your body. Your blood pressure increases, your heart rate increases, your adrenaline glands open up, and you get a burst of energy that carries you across the room to where you dial seven numbers and bark something into a phone message machine that's not very pleasant. Then you calm down. Now think about the converse. You read something in the Globe that's a good story, it's interesting, you didn't know it, and you go, huh, that's pretty good. Unfortunately, none of the physiological responses kick in. And therefore, there is no getting up, going across the hallway, banging out set. And that's human nature. I completely understand that. But I did see in my experiences on Buzzman and in trying to find out, and my job was often to find out what the globe, did the globe do something wrong and how did it happen, is that those ethics and those guidelines would often, as I said, sort of evaporate or be forgotten about in the heat of battle. So what I tried to teach my students in those courses was rather than there being rule A, B, C, D, E, and F. I mean, there are a couple of hard and fast rules. Don't plagiarize. That'll get you kicked out of business class. Don't fabricate. That will get. Don't write fiction under a byline in a newspaper if you can. And don't have a conflict of interest, which means an overt one, which means if you're covering the police department, don't accept the cases you got from the police chief at Christmas time. Other than that, I often say it was not so much what the guidelines said, but it was frankly a process of thinking about those guidelines and a process for making ethical decisions. And it was a three-step process. And the first part of it was to evaluate the situation and think about what you were dealing with and think about the story and the choices you had to make. The second one was values, which meant applying your values or the values of your news organization, and hopefully they're in sync, because if they're not, you're probably not going to be happy in either for a long time, to making the ethical decision. And the third part is sort of the result of the first two, but in some ways the most important, which was once you had applied those first two principles, you had to have come up with a system that would in effect allow you to stand up in a room like this to a community at large or your colleagues or your peers and rationally explain the decision, even if it was disagreed with, presenting coherent and cogent rationale for why you made the decision you did based on some principles that people could understand even if they didn't agree with. And that was what I basically taught people. It was a process more than necessarily the individual guidelines. If you'll notice, though, I cleverly said, employ your values or the values of your news organization. Saying what those values are is a tricky part that obviously the rabbi and the students will try and figure out, and I wish them a lot of luck. Tonight we are going to, the rabbi asked me to sort of switch this from sort of looking at it from a journalistic-centric prism to looking at it through a news-consumer prism, and to shift the role a little bit and talk about the responsibilities of the news consumer in shaping the kind of journalism he or she gets, and whether or not he or she can affect the quality of that news, and what the options are if he can't. So, hypothetically, as the rabbi and I can hash this over, and I've been a little dense, it took me a little while to figure it out, what he said was, well, here's a group of people, for example, who are very concerned about journalism, that they want journalism that's not sensationalistic, that respects privacy within boundaries, that doesn't rely on innuendo or speculation or maybe even anonymous sources. Can those consumers who are in this effectively change the behavior? Can they influence the behavior of the news producer? Or would the onus be on them largely to change their own news consuming habits to find the information that suited them? And that's what I'm going to try and talk about a little bit tonight. Let me say first that no conversation of this nature would be worth having without talking about the dramatic changes in the news environment. You guys live in Boston. I lived here for about 30 years. The simplest way I can put it is the Boston Globe was bought for $1.1 billion by the New York Times Company in 1994. 15 years later, it may be sold for $1, if that. There are people who think that the Times Company will actually have to pay whoever purchases the paper, take it off their hands. We are in an era of not only dramatic technological change in the news media, but dramatic economic change. And it's been turmoil. The changing technologies, combined with the current economy, have wreaked havoc on existing news organizations as we know. There have been massive cuts. Huge newspaper chains are in bankruptcy. Audiences for traditional media are down. The economy is terrible. And we're looking at places like cities like Boston conceivably losing the Boston Globe. An environment that I don't think anybody could have anticipated a few years ago. And that has some implications for the news consumer. So let's start with the first one, which involves technology. For people not satisfied with the news they get, I don't mean to be too glib about this, but frankly, given the low barriers to publication and the changing of technology, you can start your own news organization with remarkable simplicity and ease these days. There's something out there, a movement called citizen journalism. And it basically happens online. And it's often done by a small and committed group of people and communities who decide they want local news or some kind of news or niche news covered a certain way, and they do it on their own. Often without professional journalists, often as labor of love. Now, many of these are mom-and-pop shops, really done and inspired by the passion of individuals, but some of them are quite successful. A couple of years ago, something called the J-Lab for Interactive Media at the University of Maryland located about 700 or 800 of these experiments around the country. What does it mean? It's not quite literally, but almost we are in an age when people, communities, organizations, interest groups can become journalists in their own right. For the sake of argument tonight, I'll assume that's a little too labor-intensive for most people here to walk out immediately and decide they're going to start their own newspaper online. Clearly, the technology and dramatic fragmentation of the media makes it easier for people to pick and choose the kind of news information and information they want these days to a degree that they never could before. It can be done by content, it can be done by style, it can be done by sensibility, it can be done by ideology. You know, there's a phrase that goes around the news universe these days called the news of validation, which means that if you want to, you can spend your entire life now finding news that will do nothing but reinforce your own biases, viewpoints of the world, and never be exposed to other viewpoints or other accounts of the news. I have a feeling that we had a country, you know, I would say based on the election results of 2008, that 53% of the people in the country were watching Keith Olbermann every night on MSNBC, and 47% of the people in the country were watching Sean Hannity on Fox News every night. And if you want to live your life that way, you certainly can in this environment. That didn't used to be true. I talk a lot to young people, and I, you know, to make sure that they know I'm an old fogey, I tell them that basically where I grew up, there was the news cycle was not instantaneous. It refreshed itself every 24 hours. All of America got two things. They got a daily newspaper, usually an evening newspaper in those days, that essentially updated itself 24 hours, and they got Walter Cronkite at 7:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30, and 7 o'clock at night to tell them what went on in the world, and that was updated every 24 hours, and we believed both of them. And if you really, really wanted breaking news, and wanted to get news in a hurry rather than every 24 hours, well, you turned on the oldest media going, radio, so you could get updates on the top of the hour every hour. That was breaking news in those days. Now, obviously, we live in a completely different environment. And ironically enough, in the current economic environment, it's those old mainstream media. It's the newspapers and the Walter Cronkite operation, daily newspapers and broadcast television news that have been hit the hardest, both economically and in terms of audience. And those were the two real mass media in this country that held together communities in a way that they're not held together today, that created sort of common truisms, whether they were right or wrong, among a wide majority of people. Those are the ones that have really atomized and fragmented in this environment. The other thing I would say is that, generally speaking, the news consumer may actually have more leverage with the average news organization today than ever before. And that has a lot to do with what's happened to the economy. There was a certain journalistic arrogance and paternalism out there in the days when newspapers had a license to print money. The customer is much more valued than they used to be, frankly, because the media are so afraid of losing them. And there's much more direct access. I mean, again, one of the reasons I was hired as an ombudsman was, well, how can somebody who has a complaint ever, I mean, I used to pity people who would try and actually find a reporter, who would call into the newsroom and try to locate a reporter, talk about a story, and would be like sending into the bowels of outer space. I mean, you would be lost. No one would answer your call. No one would, the likelihood of you getting a sympathetic hero or getting any human being on the line was minuscule. Well, today, actually, reporters publish their email addresses. They publish their phone numbers. They go online to chat and take interactive conversations with the public. Not all of this is altruistic. I think a lot of it comes from a real fear about what's happening to news audiences, but it's out there. And there's much more of a direct conversation these days, if you so want one, between the news consumer and the news outlet than there used to be. But for all that, and those are in some ways positive trends in terms of the news consumer's relationship with the media, Does the news consumer have, how much power does the news consumer have to affect the kind of journalism he or she gets out there? There are, of course, advocacy groups out there who do this for a living. For those of you who live around here, you probably know one of the most effective is CAMRA. It is a group that was formed, and I did a long, long, lengthy story on that at the Boston Globe magazine some years ago. It was formed to monitor coverage of the Middle East. There's no news organization in America that has heard of them. I've been to their headquarters. They run an incredibly efficient operation. But unlike you, that takes money. It takes time, it takes commitment, and it takes organization to be a professional advocate in the news environment. And that's not something that the average individual necessarily has in terms of either time or resources. I will give you an example of what I consider to be the most dramatic example I can think of a community, organized grassroots community response to a story that I had when I was editor of the Globe. And it seemed like an innocuous enough story. A feature writer in the Living section wrote a story about a Portuguese family in Fall River some years ago. It was not a particularly memorable story. It was a lifestyle story. But essentially it focused on, I believe, a grandmother figure who was very, very old world. In her view, in her beliefs, in her habits, in her lifestyle, she put, for example, plastic over all the furniture. And it threw, do you remember that? The legacy of the star, I thought it was memorable. And through this long narrative, it sort of told this story of this real old school South Portuguese family. Well, the Portuguese community involved, to my way of thinking, there was nothing, this was an interesting story, to their way of thinking, this was brutal stereotyping. And noxious stereotyping. And they were so exercised about it that they could send me, the ombudsman, with a petition that contained 600 names, 600 signatures, asking for action on the part of the Globe. And I was pretty impressed. I met with them for lunch, and they were pretty motivated. And this was not some professional organized group. And I remember the most interesting thing is I went to the reporter and said, well, you know, I just got a pitch with 600 names on it, you know, complaining about your story. And she said, well, that's not much, is it? And I said, I'll tell you what, why don't you take a clipboard and a pencil and see how long it takes you to get 600 people to sign something that you cook up in the next hour or two. It was an incredible act of energy and organization and passion, and it didn't really generate all that much. The Globe ended up doing something that I could be one of those strange things. One paragraph in a box that wasn't quite a correction, wasn't quite a clarification. It was kind of a, oops, we got 600 people complaining, we better say something. Probably wasn't, didn't really satisfy the folks who came up with that idea. But there are examples, and plenty of them, in journalism in which news standards do change and have changed, partly at least in response to public pressure. And to public sentiment and to public desire for a better kind of journalism. I'll give you a couple examples. One is, I know this may sound strange, but there actually has been a fairly concerted effort to reduce the use of anonymous sources in the media. This is particularly true in Washington journalism, where everybody is a high-ranking official and no one ever uses their name. But it's actually true everywhere in journalism. And it was a recognition on the part of some journalists that this was an abuse and it was being used by people to abuse other people and to spread lies about other people with the cloak of anonymity, and there was a legitimate issue. But it was also the result of a lot of public outcry because essentially people didn't know where the journalism was coming from and who the sources were and what the motivations were. I can tell you when I was at the Globe, there were new practices put into effect that really dramatically outlawed not only using anonymous sources, but also if you were going to use one without naming them, you had to, in as detailed a fashion as possible, say something about them that would give a clue to the news consumer about what their motivation was. So, you know, it wasn't simple enough to say set a source on Beacon Hill, but it had to at least be set a source on Beacon Hill who was frequently opposed to government policies. So there was some movement in that area, and that was a result of some degree of public pressure. The other case that I can think about, and this is some degree public pressure and some degree some camp outrage. I spoke to this about to the students earlier today. Was many of you folks may remember the Charles Stewart case in 1989 in Boston, which was, of course, the horrific murder of a young woman and her fetus, originally blamed on a black man who jumped into a car at a stoplight near Brigham and Women's Hospital for a birthing class, and of course the whole thing turned out to be a terrible hoax perpetrated by the husband, Charles Stewart, the hoax that only unraveled, I should say, when he jumped off the Golden Bridge, and we figured out what happened. Now, I will say, I used to work at Talk Radio in Boston for a few years, and as soon as, if you remember, after the time of the story, as soon as Stewart jumped off the bridge, everybody sort of quickly put two and two together, except the Talk Radio host from the station where I was working for, who heard the news and immediately asked for a moment of silence in memory of Charles Stewart. So, not everybody got it. But if the media's rush to find the African-American perpetrator, and they actually found one, a man by the name of Willie Bennett, that actually became a living, breathing suspect in the case. You know, he had nothing to do with it. Led, as people remember, to a massive, probably largely unconstitutional, massive stopping and searching of African-Americans in Mission Hill and all over neighborhoods in Boston. That was a massive police abuse in an atmosphere caused by a media frenzy. Well, as a result of that case and the public outcry over it, one of the things that did come out of it was that in the media, in the Boston media, at least after and others, there became a prohibition against stories in which, if the perpetrator of a crime was not yet known, you were not simply allowed to name their race. In other words, we didn't do stories anymore that simply said, the police suspect a black man, or police suspect a white man, or police suspect a Hispanic. The rule became you had to actually have enough information about the individual, other descriptive characteristics, size, height, weight, age, so that someone could conceivably perhaps identify the individual or help identify. It was no longer fair to stigmatize entire groups of people based on broad swaths. So there, journalism is a living, breathing endeavor that can respond to public pressures in certain cases, and they do gain. Let me talk about when it comes to sort of news consumer sensibilities and where they sort of run afoul of mainstream media priorities. Let me talk about what, in my experience as the ombudsman of the Globe, I found to be the biggest issue and among well-intentioned news consumers. And it was the issue of privacy and, in many respects, the exposing of public pain. Of private people to a large audience. To put it simply, it was kind of a there but for the grace of God go I kind of feeling among the part of many news consumers. Well, this could happen to me. Why? Why would they make this public? Why would they intrude on someone like this? The most famous case actually was an interesting one. There was a hockey player, a BU hockey player by the name of Travis Roy. Does anyone ring a bell with anybody in this room? Okay. He was a freshman at Boston University, and I find this to be an interesting case of media ethics. And he was on the hockey team, and his first shift on the ice, and it happened to be a game that was televised, I think on Channel 68 those days or whatever, some local station used to do the Bruins, the BU hockey game. And 11 seconds into his first shift on the ice, he was knocked into the board and paralyzed permanently. He was rendered a quadriplegic. Two things sort of gave this story intensity. One was the fact that it was captured on film so that every media outlet replayed over and over and over again the accident and the incident. The second one is, and I will be candid, is that Travis Roy looked like the All-American boy. He was a blonde-haired, handsome, you know, looked like, you know, right out of the cornfields or somewhere, who, you know, just had that kind of look that, you know, somehow evinced massive sympathy and emotion from a wide swath of people. Now, what actually happened was Travis Roy went down to Atlanta, and so there was tremendous publicity about this. There were fundraising efforts on his behalf, and he became one of these sort of community cause celebs. He went down to Atlanta to rehab and do physical rehabilitation. And after some time, he came back. He wound up in Atlanta. He gave me a press conference. And so he actually wanted the media to come and see him. And he wanted to talk about how he was doing. And because there was such a high level of interest in Boston, it was televised. And a lot of the media paid attention, and the Globe and Herald wrote about it. For most of the press conference, Travis Roy was incredibly upbeat. He was positive. He was remarkably positive for a man who had just had this eye to him. At one point during that press conference, he broke down in tears. And his girlfriend, who was standing right next to him, took a tissue or a towel, a little Kleenex or something like that, a handkerchief, and leaned over and dabbed his eyes. The next day, the Boston Globe put on page one that photograph. I will tell you honestly that to say that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of phone calls and angry letters to the Globe that day is an understatement. People were furious at the idea that in this one moment of weakness, this one moment of sort of private emotion that belies the nature of the rest of the press conference, that the Globe had chosen to make that the scene and the moment of their coverage. And even his father was quoted as saying, he was very upset at this. It created such a furor that the Globe actually ran a story the next day about the public's reaction and re-ran the photo. Which, of course, then triggered a bunch of people writing letters to the Globe saying, "You idiot! You know, we're complaining about the photo, then you do a second story, then you do the photo." Interestingly enough, that story struck a chord with hundreds, if not thousands, of Globe readers who responded directly. Having said that, that same week, there was a tragedy in Brockton in which two young boys, somewhere around the ages of five, were killed in a fire when they were supposed to be under the care of their grandparents, and for some reason their grandparents left the house. I'm not even sure what the exact. But essentially, the photographer got there shortly after this happened and caught the grandparents, obviously, if you can imagine, in a moment of incredible private grief. This was not, by the way, unlike Travis Roy, I mean, this was not a press conference. This was not something they asked for. It was a painfully private moment of a horrific tragedy for that family. They ended up being exposed that way in the newspaper the next day. Interestingly enough, not many people complained about that. Another story I'll tell you about was the Gina Grant story. Don't know how many people remember this, but Gina Grant was a 19-year-old young woman who grew up in the South and had an IQ of 150. She was orphaned at an early age and lived alone for much of her life and was accepted at Harvard. And the Globe did a very, very, very glowing and positive, sort of extraordinary magazine piece about this remarkable young woman who got accepted at Harvard. Unbeknownst to the Globe at that time, somebody had sent some information to Harvard before the story was published that indicated that she had been essentially convicted of killing her mother. And truth be told, it was a complicated story. She was a juvenile. There were allegations that the mother was abusive and an alcoholic. She did not spend a great deal of time, I think it was 6 months, in juvenile detention, and the records were supposed to be sealed. Once the Globe wrote this glowing story, Harvard rescinded its acceptance of the young woman. The Globe, who was not aware of this in the first story, then essentially went wild on the story, as you can imagine, writing stories about it every day, public reaction. The public was outraged. And to some degree, they believed that the Globe was responsible for, you know, ruining this young woman's life and for focusing in on this tragedy and held the Globe culpable, essentially, for the Gina Grant story and for all the ills that befell her. Somehow invaded her privacy. By the way, the story has a reasonably happy ending. She graduated from Tufts, became bad. The Hyde Park Journal. Readers were outraged when the paper ran a page one photo of a woman collapsing in grief as her son's body was pulled out of a pond in Boston. One of the comments I got said simply, "There are some moments in life that require privacy." End of story. I once when I was writing about this and other stories, like I asked one of the globe editors what the rules are for running gut-wrenching photos of that kind of sort of private, horrific suffering. And the answer, there are very few hard and fast rules. That's
true.
That's how journalism works in those cases. I'll give you one other example that people probably remember when it comes to this kind of issue. The famous photo after the Oklahoma City bombing of the firefighter cradling the infant child. Now, there's an interesting twist to this story. Much, not everybody, but much of the public was outraged at that photo, if you remember. It was kind of an iconic image from that. It was a young, fairly dead, I believe, infant, very young child, in the arms, literally in the arms of the firefighter, caked in dust and debris, and a horrible scene out of that. And many people consider that to be a grotesque journalistic violation of privacy, decency, ethics, and everything else. It's a legitimate point of view to have. Interestingly enough, someone did the work of contacting the child's mother at some point to ask her opinion. What she said was kind of interesting. She said that she was actually gratified by the photo and appreciated it because it showed her that someone had cared for her child on its last moments in life. Not a response you would necessarily expect, but the response of the mother. When it comes to issues like invasion of privacy, it's interesting what kind of sparked public response to one day. It doesn't. They still with Travis Roy, an outpouring, a mess outpouring. With the grandparents in Boston, not so much. The public didn't seem to be particularly outraged when journalists went after a fellow by the name of Richard Jewell, was considered a suspect in the 1996 Atlanta horrific bombing. Now, two things happened. One, the media basically reported accurately that police were telling them that Richard Jewell was a suspect in this crime, which was true, although he didn't commit the crime, and they found out he did. But after that, the media also created a portrait of Richard Jewell, if you remember. And it was a strange one. With sort of the assumption that he did this, he was portrayed, if you remember, Richard was very overweight. He was portrayed as kind of a loser, cop, wannabe, mama's boy, loner, you know, strange, almost a, you know, could have been kind of a Travis Bickle type character in the De Niro movie. There was really a portrait portrayed of him as this, you know, loser, dangerous, strange, almost psychopathic kind of character. Only he didn't do it. Now, interestingly enough, when he sued for life, and several of his organizations actually gave him some money and some fought. One of them that fought was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, when during the legal proceedings about the story, was asked by Jewell's lawyers to tell them who their confidential sources were who said that Richard Jewell was a suspect we want to know who was spreading these rumors, this gossip about Richard Jewell. Well, as you know, the protection of confidential sources is a big deal in journalism. Some journalists go to jail for it. Some space is protected by something called the Shield Law, although there's no such thing as a federal Shield Law. And the reporters refused to reveal who had told them about Richie Jewell. The same thing happened with a guy by the name of Wen Ho Lee. If you remember Wen Ho Lee, he was a Chinese scientist working at Los Alamos in New Mexico, who was indicted on charges of espionage and spying for China. In roughly the same way as it happened with Richard Jewell, he was largely convicted in the media by a drip drop of stories that came out of the press about him that were clearly leaked from people close to the case. What Wen Ho Lee ultimately did and or didn't do at Los Alamos, I can't say. What I can say is that at the end, he pleaded guilty to only one charge. Everything else was dropped, and he was apologized to by both the judge in the case and President Clinton. He sued the government, claiming, essentially, invasion of privacy. And when he asked the government in the case to tell the judge and the court who it was that was essentially trying to convict him in a court of public opinion, The government said, we're not telling you. So he then went to the journalist and said, okay, you're the one who wrote the stories convicting us. We want to know your sources. And the journalist said, no. Confidentiality is a huge issue for us here. It's the linchpin of investigative journalism, being able to give someone anonymity, regardless of the quality of the information sometimes. They were fined $500 for being in contempt of court, $500 every day. At the end of the day, Wenho Lee got $1.6 million in settlement from the government, and the media organization had to pay their fair share of it. Now, from a journalist standpoint, the idea of protecting a confidential source is a huge and important issue. They will argue that otherwise you're not going to get good investigative journalism. People aren't going to be, you're not going to get whistleblowers, leakers, people in a position to be punished for what they're saying aren't going to come to you. Great investigative stories aren't going to get done. There'd never be any Watergate. There'd never be any warrantless wiretap, all those kinds of stories. Legitimate stories. But from the ethical point of view, I guess I would ask the question, should that privilege be upheld and allowed when the information being given to the journalist is wrong or misleading or aimed at a purpose or aimed at influencing the outcome of the trial? It's a good ethical question that I'll let you guys ponder. So to get back to the original point and this conversation from my point of view, the other thing I would say is the public didn't care much about, they weren't outraged by what happened to Richard Jewell. It's interesting. There's one thing I've noticed as a student of journalism. Many people believe fundamentally that the government can't run a lemonade stand successfully. But the public tends to give the government the benefit of the doubt when it comes to fulfilling perhaps the most difficult and challenging task that they have, which is finding out from an entire population who actually committed a crime. That's not easy. But if a story is published saying if someone is a suspect or someone is guilty or someone has done something or there are leaks from a grand jury, the public tends to believe, often without questioning, that someone is actually guilty, which is a little counterintuitive if you think about it. So to get back to the original question the rabbi posed to me about what do news consumers do who are concerned about these kind of issues and about influencing journalism and about perhaps if not being able to influence journalism, then somehow finding refuge in the kind of journalism that they're comfortable with or that upholds their values. And I'll say this, and I would just offer this advice before I open it up. My own view is, and I said it earlier, I think that journalism as an institution has been humbled by what's happened to it economically. There has been a virtual earthquake in the industry. And there is less hubris on the part of many journalistic institutions, which I think to some level translates into more leverage for the news consumer. Much of the older generation, and I consider myself among them, who came of age during Watergate, in the heydays of journalism, when guys like Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman to play journalists. One of the stories I love to tell people is, if you want to think about how people's opinion of journalism has changed over the years, 1970s, get all presidents met. Who played the two Washington Post guys? Robert Redford, Hollywood's number one leading man, and Dustin Hoffman, one of the great actors of all time. I think that's why I went into journalism, because I thought maybe Robert Redford played me someday. In 1999, they made a comedy about Watergate called Dick. I don't know if any of you ever saw the movie. Who played Bob Woodward? No, it wasn't Robert Redford, it was Will Ferrell. I left my case about how public opinion towards journalism has declined. But many of the people who entered the business during the Watergate era, who were heady, who came with a kind of a we know best approach to the business, have frankly retired or taken buyouts. And the newsrooms today are filled with a younger, in some ways more flexible, I think, more receptive cohort of people who understand their activity a little better. There are many more institutional and organized ways of seeking out consumer feedback, for news organizations to seek out consumer feedback. And the industry is really in a phase, and I can't stress this too strongly, of trying to reinvent itself. I mean, I kid you not when I say that nobody knows. I mean, I had a conversation with somebody here earlier about, who will buy sooner, the Boston Globe or the New York Times? I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen here. There was always a feeling of, okay, we understand the old, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the line was, old media are dying. We understand that. New media will take their place. It'll be painful. There'll be a transition. But the business model will shift successfully, and that's where things will eventually end. Everybody could sort of live with that, and maybe it would happen in 5 or 7 years. Then that new media model didn't work so well in terms of creating revenue. And then people said, well, you know what? It's not going to be a smooth baton handoff here. There might be a real downtime of 4 or 5 years when there's no money. But we'll come out on the other end. Well, I will tell you that in the past year or so, given the accelerated problems in the news industry and what's happened to the recession, that nobody knows what's going to happen to the news industry right now. I mean, it is a frantic scramble of experimentation, public policy experiments. I mean, people are talking about changing laws. There's a senator in Maryland who wants to change the tax exempt status and turn newspapers into nonprofits. I mean, there's a rush to quote-unquote save the news. It is a period of legitimate turmoil and uncertainty. It may work out great. It may be natural and evolutionary, but no one knows anymore. So the people in the business are trying to reinvent it, and in some ways they need the public's help on that, and they're willing to listen to an agreement they didn't. My advice to people who are genuinely concerned about the quality of the journalism they get is to make your voice heard. It is to complain, to blog, to call the ombudsman, to write a letter to the editor, to create feedback on a website, to organize a grassroots campaign. But I'll also tell you something else, the ombudsman. Journalism would be in bad shape if it simply molded itself and bended itself to the will of its readers. Part of journalism is, and it will always be, journalists making decisions about what's important. As a writer, I can tell you there were many times that journalists were outraged at good, important, that the public was outraged at good, important journalism. Journalism that makes somebody mad, journalism that makes somebody uncomfortable, journalism that destroys the myth that some people may have, that may be unpleasant, but if it's good and accurate, it's good journalism. So it's not necessarily the news organization's responsibility to take a public poll and base its journalism that way. Oftentimes, the complaints can be special pleading. But what the mainstream media has traditionally done wrong, and why they have invited such mistrust and skepticism, is that they have failed to explain themselves to the news consumers. And I think that's been the biggest problem. In many respects, I found as ombudsman, and so you say the business, people will disagree with decisions you make, but if you take the time to actually tell them why you've made the decision, to bring them into the conversation, to be a little more transparent, it essentially breaks down some of the antipathy, some of the wall, some of the mistrust. And journalism in the journalistic phase was very bad about that. They didn't feel like they owed their readers an explanation. Some of that is changing now. One of the things I did, I had to write a column when I was in about the Globe every 2 weeks. And one day I came out with a great way to kill 2 columns. I would put a questionnaire to readers in 1 column, and then I would give the answers in another column. So readers would have to do all the work. I came up with about 4 or 5 ethical quandaries that the Globe had been involved in. And I gave a multiple choice, said, in this case, do you think the Globe did the right thing, or should have run the photograph bigger, should not have run the photograph, should have put it on page? And I did about 4 or 5 of these questions with very well-known controversial stories that the readers had commented on. I made a comment. I told people, I'm not going to take phone calls, I'm not going to take email. If you want to respond to this questionnaire, you are going to have to, A, read it, cut it out of the newspaper, fill it out, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on the envelope, and take the envelope to the mailbox and mail it in. I made it very labor-intensive. I had no idea how many people responded. The first time I did it, over 2,000 people. That taught me something important. And many of them not only, took the time to fill in the blanks, but they added their own thoughts and ideas. And it wasn't stuff like, I'm getting Radio Free Europe on my molars, or I've been unfairly incarcerated, please help. It was truly, heartfelt comments that help understand the situation. They went even further. And that taught me that in many ways, the public was dying for some level of engagement, some kind of conversation with this misery that ended up on their doorstep every day. And I think that's one of the positive things that's actually happened in New York. There's more of that conversation going on. Well, I would advise people to seek out the best and most responsible journalism consistently. I am not a proponent of walling oneself off into the world of niche journalism, of journalism that you're comfortable with, whether it comes to ideology, content, or even necessarily style. The consumer has that option today with a cable clicker or the mouse, but it's, in my opinion, it's not a wise one. And I'll end with this little parable that a newspaper editor once had. A guy by the name of Buzz Merritt, who once was the editor of the Wichita Eagle in Kansas, wrote a cute little futuristic tale that he would sort of foresaw the day of online journalism and consumers being the ones to pick and choose what they wanted to a far greater degree than now. And he called it Harold the Rutabaga Man. And it went like this. Rutabagas are his thing. He thinks of little else. Indulging his passion requires but a keystroke or two and a few electronic impulses. Insulated from all but the knowledge he deliberately summons, Harold is content and increasingly arrogant in his expertise. Trouble is, Harold can vote. Wouldn't, of course, but could. Now, I would argue that the rutabaga man should be a metaphor, not for somebody who simply wants to get journalism about rutabagas, but for the lure of niche journalism in general. Truth be told, many people who watch changes in this industry, both economic and technological, in the universe, think the momentum is inexorably moving in that direction anyway. It's moving away from the big newsroom, it's moving away from the mass media, it's moving away from general interest news, toward a collection of narrower niche journalism, picked and choose and chosen by the news consumer. There are a lot of experiments we're seeing like this, ProPublica, an investigative unit now, created by an online operation of 25 or so investigative reporters that's going to create much of the investigative journalism for the rest of the media universe. The Common are not doing it anymore. Something here called the Global Post, I don't know if you're aware of it, it started in Boston. It was invented, actually one of the founders, a guy named Phil Balboni, who was one of the original founders of New England Cable News. And their thought was, well, international journalism is dying. Newspapers aren't paying for international journalism anymore. They closed all their foreign bureaus. So they've created their own sort of international news consortium, paying 60 or 70 stringers around the world to become kind of a clearinghouse for international news. The devolution of the media universe away from the big general interest newsroom down to the lower niche newsroom, both stylistically and content-wise, is where all the momentum is lying, frankly, at this point. And I think sampling a diverse menu of news, like eating, is a good idea. A lot of different food groups. But I would argue that it's important for news consumers to stay engaged with their mainstream outlets rather than necessarily seeking to come to the country. Thank you.
The question I want to address through these texts, and I should be upfront that these texts are a selection, and so there are many texts that would present alternatives, is to try and think about, first of all, to what extent do we have a responsibility and where does it come from to try and affect the news environment, and secondly, if we made a concerted effort to do so, what would be the value that we would seek to have right to have implemented? So the first thing, which I derived from sources 1 and 2, the notion of responsibility is formalized legally by saying that the responsibility for information spread is not just on the teller, but on the person who wants to hear it. That's formalized as a specific legal principle that all speech that should not be said, one is as responsible as one lets someone tell it to you, as if you told it yourself, and therefore, if one is a passive consumer of news that one thinks one ought not to have been published, to the extent that you bought the newspaper, you bear the responsibility. This is something that I have to say with regards to some of the examples Mark told me. I know with the privacy issue, I know that about a month ago there was a case of a toddler, I think, who rode their tricycle into the street while in their grandparents' care, and the Globe published a photo of the grandparents grieving. Why am I still subscribing to the newspaper?
I thought it was just a horrific thing to intrude on the Buddha. There was no public purpose yet. It might be the goal to argue that the goal is to teach grandparents to take better care of toddlers. However, it seems to be very, very unlikely that was the purpose of the publication. So the formalism specifically within the context of speech ethics is that accepting speech that should not have been said is as bad as speaking it. And in general, one of the really powerful principles that George Law sets out is this notion of placing a thumb on the block before the blind, which is a general notion of spiritual responsibility to the other. So anytime that one
acts in such a way that makes it more likely for somebody else to do something wrong, you share responsibility for their misdeed.
So the first book that I wanted to get out of the first two texts is the really broad principle that you always have responsibility for the environment you're in, and the specific consequence in terms of speech ethics. But then, of course, three ethics, there was a really interesting notion. So there, Rabbi Shingen, Bukhari Prayan, makes the claim that there's a difference between hearing and acceptance, that one does not have to wall oneself off from being aware that information is available, but that when information is made available to you, that you can tell in advance is going to raise ethical questions of whether you want to know this or not. Right? The information becomes available, you're going to say, well, you know what? This is going to be a story that I know is going to make me think less of lots of people or is going to invade their privacy. Right, so this is a story that I know there are ethical questions. I would know that if someone came over and whispered to me about my friends, and I can think about that just as well if I live in Somerville and there's a story about the mayor of some town in upstate Massachusetts whose wife will never change her mind. So there, the king says that the proper response is, one who wishes to fulfill his obligation, right? So you're not supposed to stick your head in the sand and not be aware of information that affects you. You need to, if the mayor of your town is doing, right, is going to town blind, you have to know that. But on the other hand, it's not at all clear that you need to know anything about the mayor of Andover if you live in Somerville. So what you do is, he says, one of the wishes to fulfill the obligation to heaven should behave as follows. If a person comes in and wishes to tell a story about his fellow, and he understands that because the person wishes to tell a story about the greatest fellow, he has to ask, is there any purpose for my knowing this information? Why should I read this story? And there are two possible reasons. One is it has a real effect on my life and I have a right to know. And the second is that I might be able to fix something in someone else's life. I might be able to fix someone in that person's life if I have a relationship with them and my moral equation is powerful.
That's rarely the consequence of newspaper articles.
I might be able to form some kind of public outrage movement. So let's say I'm probably not specifically affected by genocide in Africa, but it's important to know about it because perhaps I can create an advocacy organization that will impact on that. But he suggests that one set up a personal filter, that whenever information comes in that you know raises questions as to whether you and the world will be better off if you win this, that you ask yourself the question, does this have a purpose?
So that's a personal issue, which is very hard to do. It's very hard to open a newspaper
and raise the question, is it realistic to say, you know what, when I read certain sections, there are certain articles that much as they interest me, so, you know, from a human perspective, I'm not going to get past the headline and look at it, and if it says, you know, if there's certain ethical problems in Andover, I know immediately that it has no relationship to me. A second question, which is really even more challenging, is whether this is a question that we would want to ask the media.
Right? It's a powerful claim that truth by itself is not always a value, and this is their way of raising the question to our students when we're debating this, because they're conflicting positions.
Is the ultimate goal a society in which everyone has an exactly accurate picture of everyone else? Or is the goal to create a society in which everyone has the best possible picture of everyone else, as long as it doesn't harm them or anyone else?
Right, those are two different visions of how society ought to function. And it's worth asking about whether
one wishes to create a media environment in which the goal is accuracy in every respect, or the goal is that we need to know the things that we need to know that diminish other people in our eyes, but overall, we'd rather not.
And then the last question is also a very complicated question. Sort of 4 and 5 deal with the nuanced case. Historically, it deals with the case of a critical political leader who was warned that somebody else intended to assassinate him, and because he was very pious, he refused to believe that information. It may be a projection on the text, but from a traditional rabbinic perspective, right, it wasn't simply that he had faith in the individual person whom he was, whom somebody was telling him was a danger to him, but he said, you know what, I don't believe in listening to rumors about other people. And I'm going to act as if I had never heard that rumor, because I think it would be unethical if you listened to it. And, you know, the Talmud ends up saying, anyway, that he's responsible for the exile of Jewish people's Israel. Because, as a result, he gets assassinated. He was the Babylonian appointee as governor of Judea. When he was assassinated, Babylonians highly plausibly took this as a statement of Jewish revolt, and therefore decided that the continuation of the Jewish people in the province of Judea was unsustainable. The Talmud comes to the conclusion that, well, you know what? There are certain kinds of information that you have to be able you have to treat as possibly true on one level without, and have it affect your behavior without having it affect your attitude towards the person in question. That's a remarkably complicated position. It's parallel to some degree to the notion of staying alleged when you report on crime. The notion of staying alleged when you report on crimes, I think, has largely become a joke. Where you're telling them to say, the alleged perpetrator of the alleged crime, you name them and right? And you go on and for the rest of the, everyone knows that alleged is simply a way of protecting yourself from libel suit, slander suit. But it's interesting, but in theory, the use of the term alleged in this report was designed to create this ethical space that would say, you know what, it's important for people to know that this person has been accused, and it's also important for people to know that just because you're accused doesn't mean you're guilty. And that, let's say, if a person has been accused of regularly ignoring red lights, it's important to know that if you happen to be trying to cross the street when this car is stopped, or this car is coming towards you, but it doesn't mean that you have to believe that you ran over the guy last week. That's a very nuanced position. It means that that there's a value both in one's attitude towards the media in saying that when one is presented information about others, that one should always maintain some kind of open mind about the possibility as well. Mark mentioned this in terms of criminal trials, and I think that all of us should be aware of the work of the Innocence Project. This is founded by Barry Schreck, who's now a professor at Cadozo Law School, but he came to prominence because of his role as an O.J. Simpson defense attorney on this issue. But they've essentially discovered that people on death row, a significant percentage are objectively innocent. And you would think that death row has, that the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, if it apply anywhere, would apply in death row, and you have a shocking percentage of prisoners on death row turn out to be exonerated when you apply physical evidence. And that's a good moral lesson, that society has to have a criminal law, and the criminal law has to function in such a way that you can make the best judgment you can. But at the same time, you should be aware that people are wrongfully convicted, and certainly people are wrongfully accused. So I'm interested both in wondering whether that's a sustainable attitude towards the two together, that there's certain stories you look at and you say, you know what, that's not for me. And I have to try and filter this every time I open up my email, because AOL tends to flash gossip about celebrities on the screen before you can get your email, and I'm a dinosaur, so I have not yet managed to jump AOL and just get a screen which goes straight to Gmail and then personalize it, but nothing there. But then, and it's a spiritual ambition at this stage, because I'm really not interested in the lives of celebrities, and to the extent that I am, I shouldn't be. One notion of the filter that you can not that you cannot read the stories that genuinely there's no real purpose in having read. And secondly, that even having read them, that there's possible
to create in Mexico a willing suspension of belief. Say that you act as if you're afraid, that you act as if it's true, but somewhere in there, there's still the recognition that journalism is at best the first draft of history. Sometimes it's the first draft of that history paper. And what happens? sometimes it's the first draft of someone's novel. That's all history paper. A clear example of that, you know, by the way, for me, was the New Republic scandal some years ago, in which a particular reporter made out a story that deeply affected me, a story about a group of young conservatives who played games designed to humiliate young women. And it was, you know, it was a story that was utterly, you know, directly on point. You know, it was an attack on the moral conservative movement. Young conservatives, particularly here, these people claim to be in favor of family values and assurance of morality, and what they're doing instead is playing these deeply, deeply degrading games. Gentlemen, I don't want to repeat what the games were. Turned out to be entirely fiction. Entirely fiction, and yet, you know, I suspect that even I have a hard time erasing from memory that image of the young conservative movement, you know, because the Republic's fact-checking failed so badly. And that's why actually I did stop reading the Republic for several years. I simply could not bring myself to read it. Not so much because it made the error, but because I thought the apology was insufficient. So the question I would ask is these are, I think, models of what might be Jewish values, both as consumers, both in terms of our own virtues and in terms of our responsibility for the for society as a whole. Again, not the exclusive thing, and in terms of what Marx said is, my tendency is that the primary thing I would argue if I were talking about a Jewish ethic to consumers is that you have a process that you can defend, that you think about it well, and that you have an argument that you can defend in terms of Jewish tradition. But
I think that the sources I'm giving are
a fair presentation of a standard position of the tradition. And I just want to turn over to the audience to see, to what degree do you think this is practical, to what degree do you think these two presentations intersect with each other. What are the things you think we ought or could do individually as a community to improve both our own practice and the ethical information environment which we live in?
Yeah. Okay, I'll open up the other questions.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Sometimes I feel like it's an offense to listen to your presentation. You're trying to make the journalism written far more than at all. In the sense that I think you can't separate it out of the thinking that it's true and accurate until you first start understanding that they're true. As you consumer, I think it needs to be heralded in my individual views of the Muslim community. I have to be something. Is that at least one thing that the journalists are reading is their own law. And if they actually make the effort, yes, I believe that this body should actually verify that, or if they're using their own law based on some purpose for the defense, and in the public domain, and that's every resource that I am doing to try and do the same thing. And I think it would be a large amount of my interactions, there were changes toward not worrying about that being true. You know, not simply telling laws and news that we're pushing the agenda. And then you talk about how you can, it's great, you know, they think they're lost.
Well, my first question is why is still reading the Herald? I'm happy that you're reading something, but you know, I think you're sort of work. My sense is you're working from the big thing down, which is that there's an agenda here. And the agenda. Now, I don't know what you think the agenda is, and there may be an agenda, but that's one of the problems people obviously have with relating to the news media. Is their first thought is, they want me to think something or do something, so they're shaping the journalism, you know, to essentially achieve that goal. If you believe there's an overarching agenda in the news coverage of the newspaper, then that's, and it's one that, I mean, some people will agree with the agenda and therefore may tolerate it, and it's one you don't agree with or that you are angry at being imposed on you, then there's the fundamental, then you're going to look with a very jaded eye at a lot of the journalism there. As somebody who worked at the Globe for a long time, I mean, the Herald has a style of journalism that's tabloid journalism. We know what that is. It's replicated
that the New York Post and places around the country that are heavy on crime, sensationalism, politicians who should wear a costume when they should be doing something else, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a formula there. But the fundamental issue of whether or not a story is telling you the truth or a falsehood is crucial no matter what you believe. And I guess my question to you is, there is a difference in knowing the truth in a complex situation, which many stories are, is very difficult. Publishing something that you know to be false is a completely different animal. Publishing something that you know to be false is obviously a journalistic sin, and maybe more than that, depending on who you say about it, could be liars. And for those of you who may remember, there was a sitting judge in Massachusetts who won a $2 million libel suit against a girl a couple of years ago, despite how difficult it is to prove libel against a public figure. But there are many stories in which that are newsworthy and demand coverage in which the truth cannot be known. So the responsibility of journalism at that point is to present the facts as well as best as they can, to give all relevant parties their say, and to write what is known. But that's a different animal from essentially taking what you know to be the monster who falls in life.
Okay, sure.
I know it's coming.
Well, it's kind of frustrating. I mean, we go through the really intense conversations with a lot of people in the public community. We get to know them, they're more often people with all kinds of stuff. And all these issues. It's not going to
you know, that's a real, it's a real problem, and it's one of the disconcerting things. I mean, I in the late stage of my career, so 1 year before I moved down to New Jersey, I actually went back from the Globe to go back to the Boston Phoenix for a year because I thought I could do sort of media coverage there a little more expansively than I could at the Globe. And I wrote a blog the first time I went. And I've done, you know, and I opened this comment. And I have to say that the comments, most of the comments were disconcerting, not by their content, but by their nature. They were mean, they were nasty. I was a talk radio host for a few years on the old non-existent colors of WHDH. And, you know, in some ways it reminded me of, you know, the outraged callers who were just screaming, yelling about things. And it was, in some ways, the moral. You know, it's like, this was 16 years as I grew up in San Francisco, I'm a Yankee. So, you know, I go to Yankee Messy Court, and it's great. A Red Sox, you know, there's comments where a Red Sox fan will say something, a Yankee fan will come up with a Red Sox fan, a Red Sox fan will come up with a Yankee fan, and so you've got 37 consecutive comments with that honor of the fact that each other. And there is a surprisingly large number of that I find in the comment section of newspapers, certainly when it comes to blogs and things like that, and even newspapers themselves. I mean, a friend of mine wrote a column, it was a columnist in Boston, wrote a column in the book, looked like it literally had to shut it. And sort of said, you know, honestly, what would you, know, to readers, what would you do? Would you be willing to pay a little more? Would you be willing to save a little? And much of the comments were just an outrageous burst of, you know, I hate the Globe, yeah, I hope, you know, but basically, you know, didn't do anything to enlighten me. On some level, you can say, okay, that's a natural outgrowth of the democratization of common sense. My personal opinion of it is, and this is a very personal opinion, in many respects it does nothing to further the conversation. It does nothing to enhance people's knowledge, and I kind of come down on the side of moderating and editing those comments or leaving them out. Just because the online world doesn't mean anybody gets to do whatever they want about anybody, it's about all points. And in some ways, my sense is, you want to be treated more like a traditional letters to the editors. You know, letters to the editors, you know, if you look up crazy or made unsubstantiated charges, they weren't published. My feeling is that there needs to be more of that, frankly, than what we're seeing online.
If you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think that you should be a soldier and a person who has a child, and if you think
I mean, that's a good question. You can answer in a number of different
ways. Because I thought you started with a different challenge, which is maybe there's simply part of it affects you, but it's something that you're more educated citizen, and a more educated citizen is a more responsible citizen. And so,
I need to be.
I think you even asked the stronger question, which is that, perhaps to be a responsible voter, I need to have a sense of how endemic municipal corruption is. Right? And in order to know how endemic municipal corruption is, I need to be aware of municipal corruption for everyone. And I think there's a lot of legitimacy to that kind of claim. I happen to be into municipal corruption, so I think it's a really important. Certainly, rabbinic corruption is a really important issue for me. And and I do want to read all the stories about that, so I can have a sense of how far it applies in the community. The broader question, I suppose there is I try to avoid explicitly political religious language. Not everyone knows that, right? So there is a rabbinic distinction in terms of repentance, in which it distinguishes between repentance out of fear and repentance out of love. Repentance out of fear, the psalmist says, turns your past virtues into blank, and your past vices into blank, right? It undoes your sins. And repentance out of love turns your past sins into mitzvot. Now, how does that happen? So it seems to me that the explanation is that repentance out of fear denies a portion of the self. It says that part of my experience would never off not happening. Whereas repentance out of love says, this is who I am. Who I am is the sum of all my past experiences. And the goal is to take the sum of my past experiences and somehow make it all fit into God's plan so that that makes me capable of doing things that I would not have been able to do previously. Even if what it does is it helps me understand better the motivations of other people who are subject to the same temptations so I can help them. So in that sense, right, we'll never know. The story that I often tell about myself in this regard is that when I was in college, I had an next-door neighbor who collected tumors on occasion. And at one point, in general, with my students, I agreed to read any book or watch any movie or listen to any music that they think is really important. I guess, part of the contract is I want them to learn the things I think are important. If they're serious, they want me to read. So this student insisted that I watch a movie called Bloodsport. Bloodsport. It was Jean-Claude Van Damme. At the end of that movie, 30 seconds into the movie, I told him what the last scene would be. I said, leave now? No, you have to watch the whole thing. And so I had to watch the entire painful movie, even though I knew the ending in the first frame, basically the first frame. And one worthwhile scene was just Jean-Claude Van Damme doing a full split across two chairs. That was very impressive, painful to watch. That's really, really very impressive. It's an ambition, not what I have, but. And I thought when I finished that movie that, at some point, when God called me to account for my life, that would be about an hour and a half that I would have no accounts for. And there was just no excuse that I would watch that. And then some years later, I was sitting in a big midrash in Israel. I was part of a post-college program, a rabbinic program, and there was a post-high school program in the same building. And unsurprisingly, I kind of got tagged early as a geek. Some people can write off like one of those who really cares about learning Torah, not really in the real life for teenagers. And I was sitting there, learning my Talmud, and behind me, a few weeks in, some students are having a conversation, and they're going like, what was that movie? the one in which Van Damme does the complete split. And it's like spending 10 minutes trying to figure out what if I like, just turned around calmly and said, Bloodsport. And I was cool. I was cool. For the rest of the year, I was the cool guy who knew not what Van Damme was. I mean, then you could deal with that because I helped them, you know, especially with Sanchez. I knew 70s baseball statistics, and they thought that I knew only 70s baseball statistics. But they didn't know. They didn't know that. So I was there. There is a sense in which you never know that. But it doesn't absolve one of the responsibility of making decisions as best you can here and now. And that's the answer to that, you know. Yes, it's possible that reading a story about Mayor Vandenberg, right, 10 years from 10 years from now, right, I'll be able to prevent my great grandmother from having all her assets swindled by the Mayor Vandenberg. but I have to make decisions based on the best I can now. Okay, last question because we're going to run out of time.
Well, some of the things that
For showing up and having this conversation. I hope that you'll continue this privately more with us. I want to again urge you to make sure you've signed up with Ann Sender before we leave so you know about future events. To remind you that this Tuesday, a week from last night, Jeffrey Rosen, the legal affairs editor of the New Republic, who you probably can find at every TV station commenting on the 7 year hearing, will be here in person. And we'll be talking together about the question of whether judges should be empathetic or not. I hope that all of you will come and bring lots of friends. I hope you also check out the Torah of the site that you can find on TorahLeadership.org. And that we'll have radio stations coming together again in the future. I thank again very much to Mark for showing up and being here.